Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of October. This hour of the program, we're going to be looking at Alabama's tough new immigration law. I thought this was a moving article in the New York Times front page yesterday, and it's from Albertville, Alabama. Campbell Robertson, the reporter, writes, "The vanishing began Wednesday night, the most frightened families packing up their cars as soon as they heard the news. They left behind mobile homes, sold fully furnished for $1,000 or even less, or they just closed up and in a gesture of optimism left the keys with a neighbor. Dogs were fed one last time. If no home could be found, they were simply unleashed. 2, 5, 10 years of living here and then gone in a matter of days to Tennessee, Illinois, Oregon, Florida, Arkansas, Mexico, who knows, anywhere but Alabama." This hour, we look at Alabama. It's become the first state in the nation to require school officials to ask children enrolling for the first time about their immigration status and that of their parents. We have as our guest Professor Bill Hing, professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. And he has been pursuing social justice through a combination of community work, litigation, and scholarship. He's the author of many publications on immigration policy and race relations, including Ethical Borders, NAFTA, Globalization, and Mexican Migration, Deporting Our Souls, Morality, Values, and Immigration Policy, Defining America Through Immigration Policy, and Making and Remaking Asian America Through Immigration Policy. He's the founder of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in San Francisco and continues to volunteer as general counsel for this organization. We'll be welcoming phone calls. This is a hot topic, as you well know, and I'm sure we'll have many calls with different points of view on what we do about immigration, illegal immigration. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Bill Hing, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
So how many people have disappeared from Alabama in the last week?
Well, the various articles that have surfaced the last few days do indicate that many dozen, apparently, have not shown up for school anyway, the children. And so it's hard to say how many of the families have actually left and how many are still just waiting to see what happens. But it's clear that many people have left.
And what is the story with schools and with children? If you're reporting for school for the first time, you have to file your immigration status, or are they looking at all children in schools?
No, it requires every public elementary and secondary school to survey every student who's enrolled to determine if they've been born in Alabama or outside of Alabama, and to determine what type of status that they have.
It has been called the governor of the state has said it's the strongest immigration law in the country. Is that the truth?
Well, it's right up there. Some people called it a copycat law, attempting to emulate what Arizona did a year or so back. And they did. Alabama did go a couple steps further in terms, for example, of the requiring school kids to prove that they're lawful residents of the United States. But also, there's provisions that were upheld that forbids Alabama courts from enforcing a contract when one of the parties is unlawfully in the United States. It makes it a felony. There's another provision that was upheld that makes it a felony for an undocumented person to enter into a business transaction in the state of Alabama. So those provisions did go beyond Arizona.
And I've read somewhere that you can't drive anybody anywhere who's undocumented?
Well, yeah, there is a provision that forbids people from driving anyone who is undocumented. But you should realize that's actually a federal immigration law as well. Under federal law, it's unlawful for someone to be driving an undocumented person in their car.
We have seen news reports the last few days of people who are farmers in Alabama who have lost a huge percentage of their workforce, and they're worried if they're going to be able to survive. What has generally the business community response been to this law?
The business response has been not in favor of the law. But Alabama, as businesses in Arizona, those business folks have realized that they depend on immigrant workers, and many times the immigrant workers that they hired do not have employment authorization. And I think that the frustration that you see that they have, employers have, and the frustration that the governors of Arizona and Alabama have, is that there is a broken immigration system. There's no doubt about it. How to go about fixing it is a problem, and there is these attempts are a response to Congress's failure to do something to figure out how to solve the undocumented immigration challenge, and the fact that many employers need workers that Americans are not willing to step up to do.
The people who are in favor of the Alabama law are saying that there have been a number of former inmates who were unable to find jobs, and just since the law was enacted in June, they have been able to find more and more places for those inmates because those who are undocumented are no longer there.
Well, it would be incorrect and an overstatement on my part to say that every single job that's held by an undocumented person could not be filled by an available U.S. worker. That would be incorrect. But every economist who's looked very closely at the effect of undocumented workers in various jurisdictions, from Florida, Arizona, Alabama, throughout the South, and in California, do show that that in fact most of the jobs that are held are considered complementary workers, that they're workers that complement the workforce that of available U.S. workers, and that there's very little displacement. So there's no doubt that there are some people that would take a low-wage minimum job who are out there, but that's not generally the truth with respect to many of the jobs, such as in the fields and in certain restaurant work, certain hotel work. That's just not something that many Americans aspire to do.
Mm-hmm. How many states now, Professor Hing, have very tough immigration laws?
Well, the truth is almost every state has attempted to introduce some immigration law of its own. And when I say that, I should qualify that. Not every state itself, but every state has at least a jurisdiction, such as a city or a town, that's attempted to pass an immigration law. For example, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Farmers Branch, Texas, towns like that, they've attempted to enact ordinances, for example, that would make it illegal for a landlord to rent to an undocumented tenant. So this is happening across the country.
And I must ask, why in the world it is such a divisive issue? Maybe it's just not something that will benefit people in Congress politically, but why wouldn't Congress step up to the plate here and deal with an issue that needs to be dealt with?
Well, you're exactly right. This is another emblem of the division that we've seen in Congress the last several years, especially the last 2 years. And it's very unpopular in certain sectors to be viewed as soft on immigration, just as it's viewed in many parts of the country to be viewed as soft on crime. And so there are many people that don't want to try to figure out how to solve this problem. And when I say that, your listeners should understand that increased enforcement has not been a problem in terms of Congress. Congress has thrown billions and billions of dollars into enforcement over the last decade, especially post 9/11. There's been increased Border Patrol, there's been increased fence construction. There's been an increase in interior enforcement, meaning focusing on employers that hire undocumented workers. So that has definitely increased. But none of that has failed. None of that has been able to control the border in terms of keeping the flow of undocumented immigrants into the country. And so what that tells us is that there's something else going on. And honestly, it doesn't take much to figure that out. There's an economic problem on both sides of the border. And NAFTA, for example, had a devastating impact on Mexico since it was enacted in the early 1990s. So Mexico started losing jobs immediately after NAFTA was in place, so that, for example, corn farmers are out of business in Mexico now because they can't compete with subsidized U.S. corn. And so it doesn't really take a brain surgeon to understand that those farm workers look somewhere else to work. They can't find it in Mexico City, so they come north. And so I know listeners don't want to hear this, and the American public doesn't want to hear this, but in order to really solve the problem of undocumented immigration from Mexico, we've actually got to figure out how Mexico can get its economy back on its feet. Because if you interview undocumented workers from Mexico in particular, and let's face it, that's what the debate is about,
right.
They would rather be home. They would rather be home working, but they can't find work. These are folks that really are trying to feed their family.
Let's go back to the students for a moment. If you were a poultry worker in Alabama and you had been undocumented in this country for, let's say, 10 years, you had a child who'd been through the Alabama school system and now is probably in fifth grade or maybe in high school, couldn't there be some kind of legal challenge for removing those children from school because your parents were here in undocumented? I mean, it seems cruel, doesn't it?
It does, and in fact, that is actually a misunderstanding, and I should have been clear at the beginning. That's a misunderstanding about the law, and it may not seem important, but it is. The law actually does not authorize the schools to kick the child out of school. The law simply is, and this is the governor talking of Alabama and the law itself, it's a statistical gathering provision. It's only to figure out how many students in schools are undocumented and how many are not. They cannot ask the student not to be enrolled. So this is not about preventing the kids from enrolling in school. It's about getting the statistics. Of course, it has a chilling effect, as we've seen already in the statistics that you began the show with. People believe that the kids can't go to school. They believe that it's going to lead to the deportation of the parents. But the law doesn't provide for that. The law doesn't say that this information is going to be turned over to federal authorities.
Mm-hmm. Will there be a legal challenge to this, and what part of the law is weakest?
Well, the legal challenge to this began already, and that's why we're talking today, because the first round was mostly won by the state. There were actually at least three major challenges. One was from the federal government itself. The Department of Justice filed one lawsuit, and that was the main lawsuit, challenging the entire law, arguing that we, the federal government, are responsible for immigration enforcement, not the states, and therefore, under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, only we can regulate immigration. Okay, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And then there was a law by churches that brought a challenge against the law, saying that they can't do their business. They can't counsel. They can't talk to people. They can't drive people who need help, members of the churches, because of these provisions. That challenge was thrown out on its ear, actually. And then there was a law. Then there was a challenge by immigrants themselves that was brought by immigrant rights organizations. So where that is that almost all of the provisions that we're talking about were upheld by the federal judge. The only things that were thrown out significance is the state was told that they cannot have a separate misdemeanor crime for working undocumented in the country. The state tried to make it a crime to be working in Alabama if you're undocumented, and the judge said no, you can't do that because the federal government is right. Only they can be responsible for that. The state also tried to make it a crime to harbor an undocumented immigrant in the state, and again, that part was thrown out. So there are parts that were thrown out by the federal judge, but all of this now, but the rest of it was upheld that we've talked about already, and now this is going to be appealed to a federal court of appeals, the 11th Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, and you should know that parallel what's going on is the challenge to other state laws. Mississippi's been challenged, but most notably, again, Arizona, right. That law was challenged, and most of these similar types of provisions were thrown out in the Arizona challenge by the federal government. For example, the law that Alabama permits law enforcement to stop people that they believe are undocumented, Alabama's provision was upheld. The Arizona provision was thrown out. The Arizona law was mostly thrown out by the federal district court judge, and it continued to be thrown out by the Court of Appeals in the West Coast, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's now headed to the Supreme Court, and the Alabama law, no doubt, will either be fast-tracked and also head to the Supreme Court, or it'll be held in abeyance pending the Arizona case. There was a challenge, the Hazleton, Pennsylvania ordinance that I alluded to a little while ago, that case was thrown out. That ordinance dealing, for example, with not renting to undocumented tenants, that was thrown out by the court in Pennsylvania. It was also thrown out by the Third Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. But that case is now being held in abeyance. Just to put your viewers to sleep, your listeners to sleep even more on this legal issue, I will say one thing that's very important here. There has already been one Supreme Court decision this year on a related law. Okay, so prior to Arizona's most recent anti-immigrant law, Arizona passed another law 2 years earlier that says that employers who hire undocumented workers can lose their business license. Okay, so Arizona passed an earlier law that said that employers that hire undocumented workers will lose their business license. The Supreme Court actually upheld that law in the spring. So that was a big deal, that the Supreme Court has spoken on at least one state law and upheld it, in spite of the fact that the federal government and human rights advocates argued that that was a violation of the supremacy clause.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah.
So that case was relied upon. That case is called the U.S. Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting, and that case made a big difference to the Alabama judge's decision last week.
So essentially, was the Supreme Court saying the federal government is wrong in saying that this is a federal issue and not a state issue?
That, on the face of it, that's what it looks like. If you look a little bit beneath the surface, what the Supreme Court said actually was, well, Congress actually talked about licensing in a 1986 law, and Congress said that that if states actually want to use licensing, they can. So, in effect, what the Supreme Court's decision was very narrow. It said that that Congress actually in 1986 talked about licensing, and that they allowed the states to use licensing as a weapon if states wanted to, and so Arizona took advantage of that opening. And so I think it is an overstatement to say that the Supreme Court strictly said that the federal government doesn't have vast supremacy over this issue, but they did. It's important that they did uphold a law, and many people are interpreting the U.S. Chamber of Commerce case as giving an opening to states to enact immigration regulation laws.
We go to your phone calls in just one moment. Our number, keep it in your mind, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Bill Hing is our guest, professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, author of a number of books and publications dealing with immigration in this country, Deporting Our Souls, Morality, Values, and Immigration Policy, Ethical Borders, NAFTA, Globalization, and Mexican Migration, and others. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our calls with Victor from Oconomowoc. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Morning.
I have two issues with this law. The first one is the constitutional one that you alluded to earlier, both the Supremacy Clause and the 10th Amendment. This is states reacting piecemeal to the inability of Congress to resolve the issue. And what this does is create all sorts of uncertainty. I'm kind of interested to see how this plays out on a constitutional perspective. But my second issue with this law is that the even though it is a statistical gathering mechanism that you allude to, it is sort of a wedge into empowering or emboldening local school officials to pursue some sort of enforcement mechanism against undocumented workers. And it's my understanding that public sector entities, be they schools, programs, military, function best when they have a clear and simple mandate and a clear and simply delineated charge. And this burdens our school systems with additional overhead that distracts from the core educational mission. It in fact, weakens our schools by setting up this sort of, at first, statistical gathering mechanism, but opening a wedge to schools acting as an agent on a non-educational mission. My final point I want to make is, and then I'll hang up and listen to your response. I know people are reacting on their, closely held principles that, I believe that, illegal immigration is wrong and we need to, just enforce the borders. Well, my simple statement is this. You should never let your principles get in the way of doing what's right. Thank you, and I'll take your response.
Thanks, Victor. Thanks for the call.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate those comments. First, on the constitutional issue, in my opinion, the provisions that directly contravene what federal Congress has already done, those will be thrown out, even by the Supreme Court. In other words, when a state is trying to make it a crime to be undocumented or to transport, those kinds of things that Congress has already done federally, then that's a clear conflict, and that's clearly a contravenes the Supremacy Clause. The harder questions are when the state is trying to regulate immigration, does that violate the federal government's authority to regulate immigration, and what is regulating immigration? That's going to be the harder question by the court. So I think that some of these provisions are going to be upheld. It's clear to me that this court will uphold some of these provisions. In terms of burdening the schools, it's interesting that's an interesting point, because many of the school teachers and principals are upset at this law because they want to do the business of educating. And the reason why the state could not just outlaw undocumented kids going to public school is because the Supreme Court has spoken on that issue. Back in the early 80s, Texas tried to do that in a case called Plyler, P-L-Y-L-E-R, Plyler versus Doe. And the Supreme Court said No. When it comes to education, even if children are undocumented, they have a right to go to school. And they said philosophically, it's kind of crazy for us to not be educating these children, because the truth is that the vast majority aren't going anywhere. They're going to grow up here, and it would be crazy for us to not be educating them. It hurts us as a society if we don't educate people. And that kind of segues into his third point. Yes, technically these folks are lawbreakers. They've come across the border, most of them without inspection. But as I said earlier, if we understood why they come here, I think that the vast majority of people in the country would be a little bit more understanding, and I hope that anyway. And I think also that in better economic times, this wouldn't be such a big issue.
Well, what's with the American people? Because it's a fairly simple thing to understand why people are coming here. They're coming here to work and to support their families. Yeah. What is there not to get about that?
Well, I don't know. I don't understand. And I just I get into calm conversations with many people who do hold this line about that the listener said, "Oh, well, I don't care. I can't get past the fact that they came here illegally," and some people just can't get past that fact.
Right.
And that's when we just have to part our ways on what our values are, I suppose. And so other people are convincible. I shouldn't say that. Other people presented with the facts are more understanding, but mm-hmm. some people just can't get past that.
Yeah, Judy in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
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 This really angers me. As a grandmother, my grandchildren are 8 years old, and they go to school, and they have many friends that could be illegal aliens. You know, to target the parents are one thing. I understand that illegal aliens need to get under control. But to target the children and make them scared to leave their home is crazy. That is nuts. Instead of deporting all these families, why not help them get legal so they can be here, they can work, and they can get an education? They say we are the best country in the world, the American government. People come here. Why not prove that by helping these families instead of deporting them and making these children so scared?
Professor Hing.
Well, that's exactly what many people are hoping for, and that's the problem, is that Congress is very divisive over this issue of what is called legalization. Should we grant legalization to it's an estimated 10 to 12 million undocumented residents in the country. And Congress did this once back in 1986, and about 3 million people took advantage of the program. It was a very, very narrow program, though. It had required a lot of documentation and 5 years of residence and that type of thing. But John McCain and Ted Kennedy had a bill like this that would have granted legalization to folks in 2005-2006, and it got pretty far. But even then, within the Republican Party, people stood up and said, "No, we can't reward lawbreakers," and it fell apart. And we were really hoping, the immigrant rights community, that John McCain would maintain his position on this, but he became a different person after he ran for president. And even at one point, he supported the DREAM Act, which is for students who are undocumented that have gone to college, and it came very close in December for passing legalization to undocumented college-age students who grew up here in the country, 5 votes shy in the Senate of breaking the filibuster. And people like John McCain and Orrin Hatch, who at one time supported the DREAM Act, they turned tail, and they wouldn't even support it back then. And it's just a shame that they can't get past the politics, and these new versions of John McCain and Orrin Hatch are very disappointing.
I want to get some understanding, because it wasn't that long ago that I read reports that the Obama administration was following through on a number of deportations, thousands of deportations. And then I read in August that White House officials wanted the deportation to be halted if people were not criminals and they posed no national security threat. What is the administration's policy now on
that's really a very good question. And frankly, the immigrant rights community is really wondering as well. Okay, first, you're right. The Obama administration is on a record-setting pace of detentions and deportations. In one administration, in the Obama administration, Department of Homeland Security is on track to deport more people in one term than the George W. Bush administration deported
really?
In two terms. Absolutely. And so the deportations are up. Okay. So what the administration is saying is that, but mostly we're deporting people that are a danger to the country. And so you're right. First in June, and then in August, the White House and DHS announced that they would exercise prosecutorial discretion and not deport people who were not criminals. That in fact, they even alluded to the fact of to the DREAM Act students, and also to, for example, partners of in same-sex marriages. That because under immigration laws right now, they don't have any rights, and so people applauded that in the immigrant rights community. In fact, it's been very hit and miss, and I've been involved in two cases myself, which one was a teenager who was caught taking a pellet gun to school, and he was turned over to ICE. He was undocumented. We did get that one terminated. His parents are undocumented, and the local immigration attorneys for ICE understood that that was kind of crazy. But then, last week, unfortunately, I had I was helping with a case of a 25-year resident from undocumented from Mexico. Lived here for 25 years, worked in a local hotel in the kitchen, and two citizen kids, a 21-year-old and a 13-year-old, and he actually won his case 3 years ago in an immigration court, but that was appealed 3 years ago by the government. And his case was reversed. Well, they forced that man to leave last Friday, even though this new policy, the guy never had a crime. And believe me, I've checked with other people across the country, and it's not clear. Some DREAM Act students are being asked to leave. Many non-criminals are being asked to leave. And so the policy that was announced is being applied very inconsistently. Mm-hmm. And the administration just hasn't got its act together. Now, President Obama, he, I believe, is very committed to reform, but there's a lot of disappointment in the immigrant rights community that he's not exercising his discretion when it comes to enforcement in a little bit more consistent and humane fashion.
Mm-hmm. Judy, thanks for the call. John in Eagle River, hi.
Morning. How are you all?
All right. How are you, John?
Good.
Good.
Professor, you may know a good friend of mine who was a USF law professor, John Denver.
Absolutely. He was one of my early mentors. Yeah.
I grew up with him from the age of five. Hmm. He and I talk almost daily still. In any event, what this thing in Alabama is going to do is it really shows that the Civil War is not nearly over, and goes on and on. Going to make the commerce in Alabama and the school systems in Alabama collapse. There'll be more foreclosures. When you know that all employees know that their employers know that their employees are illegal, and the thing about going to school and not paying their way, all undocumented workers pay rent. So indirectly through their landlords, they pay 90% of the revenue that funds the schools. And if we really were serious about keeping Mexicans in Mexico, we'd pay the 500 pesos per month that it costs them to go to high school. Nobody pays that, including the Mexican government. And I guess the last 2 points, the border in along the border is like Swiss cheese. Tunnels exist, and every place you can dig. And it's just amazing. My real question was, why the Justice Department succeed in Arizona wasn't able to in this case? Who was the judge, and what are his politics?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I'll take that last one first. Actually, both of the judges, I'm not sure about the Arizona judge. The Alabama judge was appointed by George Bush, and I thought the Arizona judge, I should know this, Judge Bolton, I can't remember who appointed her, but it's often just a matter of which judge you draw, and that's just true in every area of the judicial system. That same arguments, same complaints, that kind of stuff, and two different outcomes. Honestly, the Supreme Court, who's going to hear these cases, leans conservative on these issues, and so that's why I'm pretty sure, as I said earlier, that some of these provisions are going to be upheld. Secondly, the border allusion to it being Swiss cheese, it's not as easy as it used to be. There's been billions of dollars spent on more fencing and more border patrol officers, and there's an average of one death a day at the border of people trying to come across, and people die along the desert in the summer. There's mountainous terrain that people have frozen to death during the winter, so it's not that easy coming across the border, especially after 9/11. We've spent more money on border enforcement. The economic argument is a good one, that in fact undocumented residents are taxpayers. People don't understand that the vast majority of undocumented workers actually are on the payroll. They don't get paid under the table. So all the deductions that you and I pay, they're paid by undocumented workers as well, not to mention the sales tax and property taxes and that kind of stuff. So they actually do pay for the schooling that their children benefit from. And it's interesting that a few months ago in Arizona, there was another rash of proposals, anti-immigrant proposals in Arizona, and 100 businesses in Arizona wrote a letter to the state legislators arguing, please do not pass these laws. Our businesses have suffered since SB 1070 was enacted, and sure enough, those laws were not enacted. And so businesses understand that the economy of Arizona is hurting, and I think your listener is right that Alabama is going to see the same thing, that immigrants, be they documented or undocumented, are consumers, and consumers are what drive any economy, and it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And the Alabama judge, Chrissy Fondot, was appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush.
Oh, okay. Oh, the Arizona one. I see. I understand.
Right.
The Alabama one.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, John, very much for your call. Let us go next to Boris in Boulder Junction. Hi, Boris.
Yeah, I think your guest is cherry-picking issues. There are much broader discussions on a lot of those topics, but what I want to get to is, Kathleen, 5 minutes into the program, you were asking what kind of legal measures were being taken to get after that dirty Alabama.
I didn't say dirty Alabama. Excuse me, Boris.
Both you and
please
your
quote me guest, correctly.
Both you and your guest are dancing around the legal issue by using undocumented instead of illegal. Why is that? That's counterproductive.
You want me to go first?
Go right ahead.
Well, first of all, I will defend Ms. Dunn, and I didn't call her on this, but she actually used the term illegal immigrant in her opening remarks. I always do take note of that. But, you know, Boris, if you want to call them illegal immigrants, go right ahead. I call them undocumented because there's in the immigration laws, which I look at all the time, I teach immigration law, that term illegal is not in the immigration laws, okay? And I actually do view it as a pejorative term because I don't think any human is illegal, okay? And so if you want to say that they entered illegally, if you want to say that they broke a law, fine, okay? But recently, a professional association of journalists decided not to use that term illegal. But to argue about that, that's dancing around the issue, okay? I'd rather not argue about the terminology. I'd rather argue about why people are here and what we would do, what we should do, and that kind of thing. And believe me, billions of dollars are being spent on enforcement, and it's not getting us anywhere. So we ought to be taking a different tact.
Let's go to John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Yeah, I'd like to know how your guest defines the difference between an undocumented worker and someone who's here with a visa, and the visa has expired. I have many friends in Chicago, Eastern Europeans mostly, who, you know, some of whom are here with expired visas.
Yeah.
They have Social Security numbers.
Yeah. They're also considered undocumented. Okay, so they're part of the 10 to 12 million estimate of undocumented residents in the United States. And you're right, I shouldn't to say that undocumented, and I hope I didn't say that all undocumented are Mexican, but I do think that undocumented Mexican migration is the main debate. That's what the main debate is over. But, you know, there's, for example, 10% of the undocumented are from Asian countries. Before Lecuolenza, the largest undocumented population in Chicago were Polish nationals. Here in San Francisco, there's always been a huge undocumented population of Irish
Yes.
nationals. And so, yeah, they come in all different sizes and shapes.
Yeah. We're going to take more phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about Alabama, but you can't talk about Alabama without talking about the whole country and the Supreme Court and federal policy and state policy. We're looking at Alabama's immigration law, how tough it has been on those who are here in an undocumented fashion, and why it is that we have not looked at what it is we can do to help stimulate the economy in Mexico, what these workers are doing to help the economy in America, why there is so much hoopla about immigration and people with very strong opinions, and why in the world Congress won't take this up as an issue so that we don't have to have these kinds of discussions. We have a clear policy that's a humane policy and is good for American workers. It helps people work and feed their families. That's what we're talking about this hour. Our guest is Professor Bill Hing. He's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, we have one email coming in, but we can have more if you want to send an email. talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program today, Al Worden will be joining us, Apollo 15 astronaut who's written about his experiences in falling to Earth. Let's go to an email here. This is from Elizabeth in Milwaukee. I taught in a Catholic school in Phoenix where a lot of undocumented families sent their children because they were reassured by the school's stance on immigrant rights. In Alabama, can the law require parochial schools to take part in this statistical accounting?
No, the Alabama law is public elementary and secondary schools, so they can't force private schools to do that.
Paul in Hillsboro, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I don't think that people are against the illegal immigrants as much as they are against the idea of their applying for citizenship. And I think applying for citizenship is not a quaint old 19th century, early 20th century idea that has no place in the 21st century. I think applying for citizenship is still important.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. The people are complaining that they do not apply for citizenship?
Right. They're just they cross the border and reap all their rewards and rights of.
Right. I'm glad you asked that question because, in fact, when you interview them, they want to become U.S. citizens. Okay, that's not the question. It's just that the immigration laws, it's very, very difficult to qualify. First, you have to qualify as a lawful immigrant, and then after residing here for 5 years, then you can apply to be a U.S. citizen. But these are folks that want to do the right thing. They would love it if the opportunity was presented to them to apply for lawful immigration status. The problem is that there's very narrow categories. You have to have a very close relative, like a sibling or a spouse, of course, or a parent who's a U.S. citizen to apply for you. And then sometimes, if you're married to somebody with a green card, you can become a lawful immigrant as well. So there are narrow categories. Or if you have a very special job, like in Silicon Valley, a high-tech job, something like that. But otherwise, if you're just a worker who doesn't have that type of relative or super skill, you cannot qualify to immigrate to the country. That's why this problem has arisen. There's no match between the need for the workers and the workers' own characteristics and qualities.
Marty is next in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering, Professor, if you could paint a picture for us of what the United States would look like if suddenly all undocumented workers disappeared. You know, if we woke up one morning and it was like the rapture, only undocumented workers were gone. I know for a fact it would certainly be hard to eat. A lot of hotels would go untended. Can you give us an idea of what the impact would be on life in the U.S.?
Well, I think, well, first of all, there's a movie called A Day Without Mexicans that came out about, 8 or 9 years ago that actually does exactly that, and it shows all the industries that would fall apart. There also is a book by an economist whose last name is Simon, who passed away a few years ago. It's called The Economic Consequences of Immigration, and he did something very interesting. He looked at every part of the country that had large numbers of immigrants and every part of the country that did not have many immigrants, and over a period of 100 years, and sure enough, what he found was the parts of the countries that had immigrants did better economically, they had lower unemployment rates than the parts of the countries that did not have immigrants. That those parts of the country had higher unemployment rates and worse economies, and so it wasn't hard for him. And that was over a period of 100 years, every decade. And it was a pretty convincing presentation that immigrants helped the economy.
Thanks, Marty, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call, or maybe two. David in Madison, hi.
Hi, thank you. One question, one comment. One question is, the way the right-wing Republicans use the term amnesty, I think is disingenuous. If someone were to pay a fine, an undocumented worker, pay a fine, get in line, then that's not amnesty. That's tantamount to saying that somebody served 3 months for a misdemeanor or even paid a parking fine, they got amnesty. So if you pay your fine, if that would be something that would be passed by Congress for having entered without documentation, that would not be amnesty. And the Republicans always say amnesty. The other thing is, I'd like to suggest that some group, your group or others, ask all Republican candidates for president when and how their ancestors came to this country. My guess would be that most came without documentation back in the 19th century. Thank you.
That's really a good point. You know, most people who are of Western or Northern European descent, their ancestors actually came at a time when it was essentially open borders for people from that part of the world, and so they really didn't need documentation. They couldn't have diseases, and they couldn't be criminals. But other than that, it was pretty much open borders. In terms of the fine, the McCain-Kennedy bill and other iterations of these legalization bills do require a hefty fine to be paid, $1,000 to $2,000 of a fine, and also there's a waiting period. Under McCain-Kennedy, people would have to wait many years before they actually got their lawful permanent resident card. So it wasn't just come on in and we'll give you citizenship.
Don't you wish that those who are supposed to be in charge of coming up with a policy and looking at what's fair and what's fair to human beings would do their jobs? This is just a mess.
It definitely is, and I wish that people would own up to that mess and say, you know what, let's roll up our sleeves and let's do something right here, because we are talking about human beings. We're actually not talking about commodities, and we haven't even talked about it this hour, but raids and arrests and that kind of stuff, and mm-hmm. people breaking up and mm-hmm. holding facilities with nursing mothers.
Mm-hmm. That'll be our next show.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. We will do another show on this. Professor Bill Hing, professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, discussing our immigration policy or lack thereof. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're going to continue in a moment.